It's still November 21st, and we're still here with the Browsons, and now we're going to talk to Timmy about what brought him here to Kodiak, and sort of maybe tell us a little bit about before that.
Well, to begin with, I was born in 1913, so this is not some few years ago. Navy parentage, and the usual experiences with in that sort of service in childhood. My sister was born, I was born in Washington, D.C. My father was on duty at the time at the Naval Radio Station. About a year and a half later, we were in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and my sister was born there. So then back to the States, and subsequently he retired, and eventually I joined the Navy, enlisted. And about 1932, and served on various ships until 1942, when I was commissioned. And then eventually in 1954, late, I was ordered to Kodiak on the staff of Commander Alaskan Sea Frontier and the Commandant of the Naval 17th Naval District. At that point, I had been ordered up here as assistant to staff for attendant personnel, but that billet had been taken just before I got here by another person, so I became the district in Comal Sea Frontier Ordnance Officer, responsible for the equipment for the guns and personnel throughout the district from ADAC to Juneau. That lasted for about a year. And at the time I moved over and became at that time what we called the officer for the control of naval shipping. This job was very interesting in that at that particular time, all of the Alaskan Sea Frontier was under naval control, and all vessels, civilian and military, entering the district or immediately became under the control of the Commandant. And that lasted for about another year and a half, and very interesting work, and eventually we were transferred. I went back to California at that time it was known as the Ordnance Station at Port Chicago. It later became the Naval Weapons Facility that also had Concord. Then that lasted for about 30 months, and we were ordered back to Alaska to the same staff, and I arrived in about late October, I think it was, somewhere around 1954. Shortly thereafter, about early in 1955, to be followed by the family. In preparation for the families coming up, one of the more interesting aspects was a search for a house for them. And I arrived up here, and at that particular time, the Aleutian home had just completed. And I went in to the manager of the homes and said, I understand that there are places available, and he said, yes, there are some 153 of them out there. And I said, well, how do I apply for one? He said, you just walk around and take the one you want. There's none of them being utilized at this point. So that's how we eventually came to live here. At that time, I think, as Billy had related, quarters on the base were dependent upon the job that you had. Certain jobs required living on the base, whereas others, quarters was not an entitlement, so you had to find places to live in town. But anyhow, that went on. Very interesting tours of duty, and as I think she had spoken, the orientation as far as disasters were concerned, on the naval base at the time, were mostly oriented around the danger of an A bomb. People didn't even think of tsunamis. So all of the evacuation plans and so forth were oriented around protecting the people from a very terrible blast. And one of the areas that they had at that time was to take the family out toward what used to be the ski chalet to an ammunition storage area. And those were actually very heavily made steel corrugated structures, which had been earth covered. But then time went on, and what I might say that as far as the command posts were concerned, on the nearly twice a year exercises that we had with the Alaskan Command, we would have to establish a command post. And one of the command posts that was very well established is now located just on the shore side over the hill from Boy Scout Lake. There's an entire underground command post there that had been completely earth covered. And at the time that the Navy left here, around about 1972, they pushed some more dirt up around the entrances and pretty well disguised it. But there were other command posts here, number one, of course, the one that we know about in Fort Abercrombie. And then there is one at Chiniac, which is also a very fine command post. So between those three, and also utilizing the communications facility at Holiday Beach, the command directed its activities during these exercises. After 1962, when I retired, I, of course, was thinking, gee, I'd just like nothing to do for a while. And this, of course, wore pretty thin after a while. So a good friend of mine, whose name was Emil Knudsen, who had a shop in town near, at that time, Crafts, and this was prior to, of course, the hurricane, the tidal wave, because I retired in 1962. So I went to work for him as managing his photography and outdoor stores that he had there. And then that lasted until about June of the next year, when he finally retired and sold out. And subsequently, I then went to work for a logistics company, and who, as the manager of the contract that they had to logistically support the Air Force Station at Chiniac. That facility was originally built as a part of the Dugan, but then had fallen into disuse, and it wasn't used as that sort of a station. It was offered to the Navy at one time. The Navy declined to use it, although adjacent to it, they already had a station that was a low-frequency direction finder station. It would have seemed that they would have taken advantage of that, however, for some reason they didn't. And so the Air Force then took it over because it was ideally located to track the new missiles that were being fired, orientation over the earth. So I was out there for a year, and this was during the period when the tidal wave occurred.
big of a, how many people were involved? How big of an operation was that?
How big of an operation? There was a total of 80 people out there, and approximately 60 of them were of technical people. The technical aspects of tracking the missile routes were controlled either by Lockheed or Philco, depending on who got the contract at the time. The logistics support for the place, and that was maintenance of buildings and grounds, power generation, food service, and all this sort of thing, was bid annually by the Air Force. And that's where I came in, because my company had bid into it, needed someone out there. So anyhow, at that particular time, during the year that I was there, the tidal wave occurred, and it was an extremely interesting period of time out there. In the building was very well constructed, but it just shook furiously. It shook so much that we couldn't keep the circuit breakers in the power plant, and of course lost electricity. Now, one of the things that people see when they approach a tracking station is they have these big domes or balls. Well, those things are simply coverings for the what you would call the tracking implements that track the missiles that go by, or whatever they need. Well, these things are inflated by air, they aren't permanent. So when you lose power, you lose compressors, and the air ceases to flow, so these things gently but firmly collapse. And in about 45 minutes, they're totally collapsed and almost impossible to raise again without extreme amount of pressure. Well, it was quite a session out there, quite a time when we had to bring the power back on and get the compressors going. And although they sort of flattened out in certain areas, we still kept them inflated. And the building is well constructed, and the only problems that we had, of course, was the examination for fire hazard, where lights had been knocked over in the building area. I think one of the more interesting aspects of this was that, as in every other military organization, evacuation plans are nearly always extant. So the Air Force had a very fine evacuation plan, which called for all of the dependents in Kodiak to be taken to that Air Force facility at Kodiak. The plans were very well laid. The Navy had what we call the R5Ds. I think the Air Force called them the C-54s along about that time. But they were a fine Douglas airplane. So the Navy flew all of the dependents out to the landing strip that's near Chiniac, and subsequently came on up to the facility. Now you can imagine that this facility is equipped for approximately 80 people. And we have rooms and all sorts of other necessary facilities for that number. And when all of the dependents had arrived with the children, we were populated by something like 220 people. Well, the difference between the 80 and the 220, of course, were either babies or wives or whatnot. And suddenly, they discovered that they had forgotten certain things in their operational evacuation plan. They hadn't provided for any baby food, for instance. and they hadn't provided for the necessary things that women need. So we had quite a time getting all of that information in. It was finally flown in about 2-3 days later, and everything settled down. They were there for about 10 days, and when the earthquake was over and everything subsided, they were flown back in again and came back to Kodiak like they decided. But it was a very interesting period of time. If you can imagine, 80 men in about, 80 minus 220, various female types around the building of that sort, all sorts of things were going on. We had wall-to-wall mattresses, as a matter of fact. Fortunately, the food was no problem, simply because the operation plan had called for a minimum of 3 months' supply of food for 80 people. But then after that was over, the company that I was working for lost the contract in July of that year. Tidal Wave was in March, and the contract ended in July. So I gratefully accepted another rest period, which wore thin after a while. And then Sealand came into Kodiak in September of 1965. And September of 1964. And then in 1965, I was hired by Sealand. It was a very pleasant job for me, simply because Captain James D. Polk, who had been my commanding officer when he had been the chief of staff and I was his assistant when we were both on duty at the Commander RLC Frontier before I retired. He approached me and wanted to know if I'd like to go to West to work, and I said, why certainly. So that was the beginning. I was hired in May the 17th of 1965, and I stayed with Sealand until late in 1987. And it was a very fine second or third career, whichever you want to call it.
Did you do a lot with the startup then?
Oh yes.
What kind of things were you involved?
That was. I'm glad you asked the question. That's a very interesting aspect of the beginning. When Falk was hired, he was hired by them without any supporting personnel at all. We know that it's necessary to move vans around and have trucks and all this sort of thing. Well, that was accomplished by letting a contract to a local company who had a trucking capability. And that outfit was Felton and Tenney. Felton was a local man, and his partner was Tenney, and Gene Tenney. And they had this trucking firm that would haul for anybody. Well, the Sealand company offered them, and they accepted the contract to move in. So that was no problem. However, I'll call him J.D. J.D. Falk was extremely busy. He had retired after 30-some-odd years in the Naval Service. And was not only required to take care of all of the customer services, all of the claims, the operational aspect, the loading of the equipment on board ships and so forth. So he was pretty well worn down by a job that was almost about 24 hours a day. And so I was, knowing him as well as I did, I was very happy to go to work and give him a hand. We, Seaman came into Kodiak following Alaska Steam. Alaska Steam was essentially a break bulk carrier in that they didn't use containers. They loaded it and freighted into the hold and so forth. Well, when Sealand came in, they had this container concept where containers were moved around and loaded and then loaded on the ships. Well, one of the more interesting aspects of this was that the fishing industry in Kodiak was oriented primarily to refrigeration, or a product that had to be refrigerated. Well, that was fine. Sealand had the equipment. However, the power generation in Kodiak at that time was 220 volts. Sealand came in with refrigeration equipment that required 440. But they had a power pack on these units that would run by propane. And it was a little old man engine. And all you had to do was hang a propane bottle on it and then tend the thing. And this became very interesting because sometimes the propane ran out. And I can remember J.D. Culp very well. He was not given any sort of a vehicle by the company at that time. And he had an old Ford station wagon. And he used to load those big 150-pound propane tanks on his station wagon and go around and hang them on these various equipment. Well, soon after that, the company gave us to haul these things around. But it became almost a 24-hour-day thing because, of course, the propane would run out, the engines would stop, and the canneries would complain. And we'd have to go back down and start the thing up again. That was fine. We didn't have any terminal in town. So J.D. had made an arrangement with the naval station that Sealand equipped a building on Nyman's Peninsula. At that time the building was S-12. And it was wired for 440. And we could back the vans in there waiting for the ship to come in. And the ships came in at Nyman's Peninsula in the old cargo piers that are now pretty well washed out. But at this particular time, it was great up until the tidal wave occurred.
They actually noticed
this
was after the tidal
wave. Oh, this was before.
The tideway. They loaded right down there in those cargo
containers. They were loaded on the cargo.
Containers.
That's right, the whole container. The ship came along the cargo dock. That's where that big blue building is located down there. Okay, then what happened at the time, the tidal wave, and then all of the refrigerated vans that we couldn't keep on the 12 plug-ins that we had at S-12. They were parked down on the end of Nyman's Peninsula, and we kept them on propane. And when the wave came in, of course, it just washed all up on Nyman's Peninsula. And the vans, of course, the propane bottles were washed away, and the vans stopped and so forth. And it was about, we had to wait for the tide before we could go down and reservice them. But this was all accomplished, no product was lost. So finally we got everything going, and the ship continued to come on in, and we loaded them out. Sealand after that time grew, primarily to the efforts of the sales people in Anchorage, who came down and offered a step-up transformer to the canneries that step the voltage up from 220 to 440 so that they could use a van. It was a smart sales move. We put them all over town, and we had something like 18 transformers at the time that they were supplied. Put a couple of them out at the naval station at the time. But then it grew, and Alaska Steam finally called it quits, and they had a couple of disasters just prior to that time, which didn't help them a bit. Vessel running aground up in somewhere around the Alaska Peninsula. But in any case, eventually in 1987, I finally retired from Chile.
I assume the canneries were happy to have some. Were they instrumental in bringing them in?
I am not too sure whether they were instrumental in bringing them in. They were happy to see another service, simply from the real basic standpoint, the competition is always good. However, there were certain attendant problems with Sealand coming in, and they stemmed primarily from the fact that Alaska Steam finally decided that they would use some containers, and they came in with a little 25 foot length container, which was small, and many of the canneries in town at that time were small, and that size container fitted their cannery operation very well. So when Sealand came in with the larger 35 foot containers, it presented a problem. It was a container that they couldn't even fill within, let's say, an acceptable demurrage time. When you talk about containers and railroad cars and so forth, you must get into a demurrage thing, which means that you as a customer can have the certain container to fill it within a certain period of time. Beyond that time, you charge your charge the penalty for holding it. So it took them a lot longer to begin with to adapt to the bigger container. But then as the seafood processors began to grow, they began to generate this additional freight, and it became less and less a problem.
Was Alaska Steam, were they a local company, or were they owned local, or were they?
At that time, as far as I know, most of the canneries were not owned locally, let's say, but they were probably owned by a company in Seattle, something of that sort. The financial aspect of it, who owned what?
Was there pretty stiff going there in the beginning between the two companies?
Oh yes, there was a great deal of competition between the two shipping companies. But of course, when Alaska Steam phased out, I enjoyed there for quite some time a monopoly until an outfit called Tote came in. Tote didn't come in to Kodiak, but Tote impacted on Sealand's operations in Anchorage and on the mainland of Alaska. It was until quite some time later before the president came in. But in any case, I finally retired. And since 1987, I've enjoyed being very, very busy keeping things going, and just simply enjoying primarily what I'd like to do.
Okay, I'd like to go back, maybe, and maybe talk about when you were first here in the early 50s. What sort of a relationship was there between the base and town in what you were doing. Was there any civilian involvement at all with projects you worked on for the Navy? Or were you pretty much, the Navy strictly stayed to themselves, and was there much civilian
involvement? Let's go back a little bit before then. 1954, in my relationship with, in my job, any relationship with the town was almost nil. I just didn't have that sort of a job. However, the relationship between the Navy and the town, and I think I can cover this pretty well, depended primarily, it seemed to me, upon the personalities involved both in town and the senior officers on the Navy base. And it varied, of course, from very good to not very bad, but just sort of on the fence, so to speak. But it was more of a personality sort of thing. And as far as the, let's say, the influence or impact of hiring local people was concerned, one had to remember that the naval station at that time, as far as its civilian personnel was concerned, they were primarily civil service, and as such were hired outside of the local area. Certainly, there were certain jobs that were available and were filled by local people, but the civil service people, being of a different means of recruiting, that was normally done from outside, and so that they were hired, let's say, in Seattle and San Jose. So one has to really understand the workings of civil service employment to understand this sort of thing, which is, and that's a bit complicated.
Sure.
But anyhow, the relationship was, I would say, on the whole, between the naval station and the town, extremely friendly and very good, very supportive on, as far as both areas were concerned. There were certain aspects which were understandably of a frictional nature. For instance, when we first arrived here, there was a CB battalion, construction battalion, on the base, and they were used here in Kodiak, and they were used in other places in Alaska, primarily out of Virginia, to clean up certain aspects. But they became targets of a union problem. And before that really came to an end, the CBs used, particularly here in Kodiak, they used Kodiak as a training area for their construction effort, roads and buildings and all that sort of thing. They would have a period of time where, for instance, they paved the first road to town. And they did other work out through the chain that was required. But then, of course, the aspect of a military organization during work that could well be done by a civilian operating engineer came into being. So eventually, the Navy Department was required to remove the seaweeds from Kodiak and from the Alaska Sierra, so that depending upon one's aspect, that's a very good thing. The construction people are doing what they should be doing now and building roads and buildings and whatnot. The CPEs are training for what they should be doing down in Fort Winnebago, and everybody's extremely happy about this thing. Perhaps, maybe, except a few CPEs who used to have a lot of fun. They, for instance, one of the things that the CPEs did while they were here, in addition to their other duties, they had what they called a R&R program. They always maintained the road to Sault de Côte. And usually what they did was they would divide themselves into four segments. They called them watches. And one fourth of the people would be off doing little extraneous things like maintain the road to Sault de Côte, and along with that they would catch and fish and smoke salmon. Their goal was that every man in the battalion would have at least one case of smoked salmon, canned salmon, to take home with them. But they did an awful lot of good as far as keeping things open. And they maintained the road as far as Chignac was concerned quite a time. She's away from CBs now. But that's an interesting little anecdote. When we first arrived, there were four gates that one had to pass through, four sentry places that one had to pass through in order to leave the base. One of them, which probably drew the most attention, was a gate that was at the foot of what is now known as Marine Hill. That's something all the way around the end of Wilkes Bay when you go up. Well, everybody that left the base had to check out. And they were required, of course, name and all this sort of thing, and where are you going, and when do you expect to return? All of which was made a matter of law. So, these, of course, when came time for certain so-and-so to be coming back in, and they weren't in, well, then, of course, the inquiry came, where are they and how are they? And then this eventually led to searches. And the findings were oftentimes quite compromising. But in any case, these were the times when I think Billy alluded to the fact that you could go out on the road system in Kodiak and leave your car and not have anything to worry about. You could have a little cabin out there and not have anything to worry about as far as it was concerned. And normally you could go for it could just sit there for two, 3, or 4 weeks. And eventually, big concern was where and how is the owner? Not, are we gonna blow this car away and steal all the tires and do other things? I know that on one occasion I was bear hunting, and my partner and I were over at Eagle Harbor, the other side of Ugak Bay, and we were supposed to be back, and we left our vehicle parked at the hijacked. We were supposed to be back a couple of days ahead of that time. We weren't. So unmistakably, we heard the sound of a chopper coming in. And it was one of our good friends who was the pilot, Coast Guard captain by the name of Paul Reed. Paul parked his chopper near our tent, and he came on in, and not both of us, not knowing what Paul was there for, we said, "Hi, Paul, come on in and have a cup of coffee." You know, and so Paul said, "Think of Will." You know, we'd all been funny buddies before, and so Paul had his cup of coffee, and he got up and he said, "Well, I got to go back, guys." And he said, "Which one of you are coming back with me?" So we had found out that between my wife, Billy, and my partner's wife, Marty Gunderson, somebody had pushed the panic button and thought that we were in trouble. So they had sent the rescue out after us, and of course Paul was entirely correct because he had to bring somebody back. So it was a very nice trip coming back. It was one of those very foggy days, and we would have sat over there for a couple more days waiting for the clock to go. But Paul and I flew back in that chopper, and I swear the fog was so low on the ground I could have dragged my foot all the way back. But you know, we got back on. Everybody was relieved.
Was there much of a limit on where you could, were you restricted as far as where you could go again?
No.
Well, you were talking about having to check out and check
in. It was just simply a matter of checking out.
Checking
out.
So that everybody knew.
Back in at the time. As far as restriction was concerned, it was quite lax. Go almost anywhere you wanted. At that particular time, in order to be able to hunt, the only requirement was that you had to be here a year. Where you went was your own business. You didn't have to hire a guide at the time. You could just wander off if you wanted to. Rational people always went at least two people together. And that was the case that in which we were. Oh, that's a nice one. As the ordnance officer for the frontier commander, I had one very interesting and amusing experience. And later, he turned out to be a very good friend of mine. But this man's name was Joe Zentner. And Joe Zentner was a homesteader. And his house was at the Sag Shack. It's now where the park area it was, where the park area is now. And Joe was a very interesting character. He lived alone. And he flew a little Piper airplane. He was a rancher, and in addition to that, he owned the flats there at the Sag Shack. He had a certain amount of growing that he did as far as feed for his cattle. And his ranch extended from what is now almost Kelsen Bay, all the way back to the fence that runs across the road on the way to the Nowakate Ranch. It was quite extensive, and he grazed cattle all the way over as far as Portage and the Salt Lake. Beyond his and Omanok toward the Bear Preserve, there was another rancher. Now, where?
Johnson. us here.